All right, now hear me out on this one. What if we just shut it down? The whole southern border, just shut it all down. What do you think? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, today, the 2nd of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Full disclosure, I suppose, that whole close of the southern border thing, not my original idea.
If we don't make a deal with Congress, the border is going to be closed, 100%.
President Trump, obviously in the Oval Office today. White House aides had been hemming and hawing all day about whether the president was really serious about his threat to close the border with Mexico. Security is his main concern, the president says. And as you just heard, he is completely serious. Except the economy. Sure, there will be avocado shortages and whatnot if the president goes through with his threat. But let's think really big here, shall we? Say, the entire American automobile industry? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson gets us going.
Let's start really small with a car seat.
The leather, the foam, the little electronic bit that moves it forward and backward and changes the incline.
Many of those bits were made or assembled in Mexico, says Keith Head, a professor at the University of British Columbia.
Along the way, it may have gone back 2, 3, 4 times across the Texas border into Mexico and back to the U.S.
And without a certain piece, you can't make a seat. Without seats, you can't make a car.
You know, it's like that story about for the want of a nail, the battle was lost.
Automakers simply don't stockpile their parts. They have them delivered as they're needed. And there are lots of parts that can only be sourced in Mexico, says Kristen Gicek with the Center for Automotive Research.
We would see a ripple effect pretty quickly. I think within a week, we would shut down almost all of the U.S. automotive industry.
Yeah, shut down within a week. Michelle Krebs is an analyst with AutoTrader.
We saw that with the earthquakes in Japan. There was one electric component. It shut down a lot of plants, not just Japanese, but American ones, because that's where they got that.
This would be much, much bigger. In fact, Charles Chesbro, an economist at Cox Automotive, says the consequences would be so dramatic.
I just don't see how the president could do this for more than a day or two without. It would make no economic sense to leave something like this in place.
The auto supply chain between the U.S. and Mexico is so integrated, one simply can't function without the other. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
More almost surely to come on that story. Corporate America brings us this story today. Walgreens and a cut in its 2019 earnings forecast and lower than expected quarterly profits. The chain has a couple of problems right now. Sales are down in front of the pharmacy counter from cough syrup to cigarettes, but also trouble behind the counter. Walgreens is starting to feel a fundamental shift in the economics of drug pricing, as Marketplace's Jack Stewart explains.
Walgreens reported a 3.8% drop in retail sales for its latest quarter, blaming a weak cough, cold and flu season and also a gradual shift away from tobacco sales. And, says Dan Mendelson, healthcare consultant at Avalere,
in a world where the consumer wants to get their drugs delivered to their home by Amazon or another online pharmacy, those consumers are just not coming into the retail establishment.
And if people aren't coming in to pick up their meds, then they're not going to impulse buy candy or batteries either. An even bigger problem, though, is at the pharmacy counter. Generic drugs are getting cheaper, and the more expensive specialty drugs are less of a profit center than they were. Walgreens isn't getting the deals it used to, because there's been a ton of consolidation among insurance companies and the firms that negotiate drug prices for them, pharmacy benefit managers, or PBMs. That's according to Wally Jelad at the University of Pittsburgh.
So that allows them to put some pressure on pharmacies in a number of ways, and that's what you see. You see reduced profit margins at the pharmacy.
Rachel Sachs at Washington University says Walgreens is perhaps being squeezed more than others because it's not able to navigate this changing world of drug prices in-house, unlike one of its chief rivals, CVS.
Because CVS has its own in-house PBM, it may have the ability to drive harder bargains.
Going forward, Walgreens says it'll emphasize things like in-person consultations and in-store immunizations to get more people into the stores. You know, the things that you can't do online. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
Speaking of online, there is a development today in the Walmart-Amazon clash of titans, two ginormous companies trying to be all things to all consumers. Walmart has made a deal with Google to bring voice-activated online shopping to its customers. You'll be able to say, and apologies if this sets off your device, but you'll be able to say, hey, Google, talk to Walmart, and then make Walmart orders while they are cooking or checking the fridge. Marketplace's Renata Sago has that one.
One of Walmart's biggest advantages is that it's big. It's the largest grocer in the country. It's got 4,700 stores. Half of them offer grocery drive-through and pickup for online orders. 800 of its stores deliver. Walmart's first forays into grocery e-commerce didn't go so well. But after adding more than 30,000 personal shoppers, analyst Jan Rogers-Niffen says the retailer's getting better at fulfilling online orders.
Walmart has been getting more and more and more efficient on how to gather that product up, get it out to your car, or hand it to you in the store when you come to pick it up.
Second advantage, consumers know Walmart as a grocery store. Niffen says 58% of shoppers bought groceries there over a three-month period last year, and the retailer has been boosting its array of grocery products.
They've got better fresh fruit now. They've got better fresh vegetables. They've got a better meat section. They've got organic now.
Third advantage, logistics, logistics, logistics.
Walmart has been stocking stores since Walmart was founded.
Charlie O'Shea is lead retail analyst for Moody's. He says Walmart can use its stores as fulfillment centers. So unlike its online competitor, Walmart is in direct contact with customers.
Amazon fulfills and uses third parties to handle most of its last mile deliveries. Walmart controls that last mile by virtue of the store base.
Walmart says it wants its new Google partnership to help it offer customers what they want before they even know they want it. Kind of sounds like Amazon, huh? I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Tuesday, you know, whatevs. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's an important caveat to a story you might have seen out and about today, the Equal Pay Day story, that today is how far into 2019 a woman has to work to make what a man made by the end of 2018. The caveat is that today is Equal Pay Day for white women. Women of color have to work even farther into the year to catch up. But the pay gap, in whatever variety, is not a new thing in this economy. And one way people have been trying to overcome it is by getting more education, advanced degrees in particular, MBAs, for instance. But as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, for women and people of color, that doesn't always work.
There's a nonprofit group called the Forte Foundation that works with businesses and business schools to advance women in leadership. Its method of choice, the MBA.
It's still a huge economic mobility engine for women and for minorities in terms of where they end up in their compensation.
That's Alyssa Sangster, the Forte Foundation's CEO. It recently conducted a study that surveyed male and female MBA alums about their salaries, before they got their degrees and for several years after. Sangster says the MBA degree does increase incomes. Women get a 63% pay bump on average. Women of color get a 70% bump. But raises aside, does the degree get rid of the pay gap?
Our expectation was that we would find that the MBA was a great equalizer in terms of salary.
Turns out it's not. For people of color, the gap persisted. For women, the gap widened by 7%. The biggest gap, women of color, who end up receiving 52% less than their white male counterparts. I ran the study by London Gage. She's a first-year MBA student at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business.
I wouldn't say I was surprised. At all.
Gage is black. She's 28, and she spent 4.5 years in the private sector before business school. She also just wrapped up a big round of summer internship interviews where she says finance internships are mostly going to white men.
And so I think it's even harder as women try to break into these male-dominated spaces.
The Forte Foundation study found minority MBA graduates reported lower satisfaction in salary and career progression. Women reported they were less likely to win promotions than men. Claudia Golden, an economics professor at Harvard, has also studied the gender pay gap among MBA holders. She says there's another factor making the gap grow over time.
The widening is much greater for women who have kids.
Having kids requires flexibility. Having flexibility requires hours you can control.
The corporate and the financial sectors are not ones that allow for controllable hours.
Finance companies have made efforts to make their workforces look less white and male. For instance, Goldman Sachs recently said it would interview two diverse candidates for each job opening. London Gage at the University of Michigan says she's seen companies show off all kinds of diversity initiatives on campus.
You know, I know that it says kind of all this on paper, but if I do get in the door as a Black woman, what is my career progression going to look like? Is my bonus structure going to be the same as my white male counterparts?
Gage says as MBA students approach the job market, the impetus still falls on women and students of color to interview the interviewers about how their companies pay their employees. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
There you are, sitting around the house, minding your own business, and the phone rings for the umpteenth time that day. Another robocall with one scam or another on the other end. Alex W. Palmer writes about the guy behind literally 100 million of those calls before being slapped with the biggest fine ever by the Federal Communications Commission. It's a piece in Wired called On the Trail of the Robocall King. Alex, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I need you to give me just sort of the high-level overview of how you came onto this story and what the search for the king of robocalls, how it got started.
Yeah, I had been, like every American, receiving all these strange calls from numbers that looked like mine, and I kept wondering, who are these people on the other end of the phone? Who are these people trying to scam us? And then I came across the news story, just a little blurb about the FCC issuing its largest ever fine against someone they called the kingpin of robocalling. And I thought, that sounds like a story to me. And especially when I learned that he had actually been tracked down in part by TripAdvisor, by an investigator at their team who had dedicated himself to uncovering who was behind this massive spoofing operation. And I went about trying to figure out that story.
All right. And what was the TripAdvisor part of this? Because it was, I mean, fictitious is the word that comes to mind, but the scam was bogus, right? As are most scams.
Right. So it was a automated call coming into phone lines in the U.S. saying, congratulations, you've received 2,000 TripAdvisor credits. That you can use these for a great vacation in the Caribbean. Press 1 to learn more. And what upset TripAdvisor, of course, was that, one, they don't do credits. That's not a thing. And two, they don't do telemarketing, much less robocalling. And it just so happened that whoever was directing this scheme placed one of these calls, and it went to the wife of TripAdvisor's general counsel. Mm. And she was tuned in enough to know that this didn't sound right and asked her husband to what was going on.
All right. So let's unbury the lead here. The king of robocalls is a guy by the name of Adrian Abramovich. He has, as you've said, been fined a whole lot of money by the federal government. Who is he? And what was it like when, I guess, would you go like to Miami and knock on his door or something?
I did. I found his address the same way he probably found a lot of the people he called, which was in a public database listing his name, phone number, address, and showed up, knocked. And there he was. He has a long history operating in Florida. According to the FCC, he's formed at least a dozen corporations over the last 20 years. Most of them are in telemarketing, some sort of advertising, sales over the phone. But this was the first time that he's really gotten the harsh glare of the national spotlight on him, and especially getting a record fine.
Abramovich gets caught, obviously, but there are, I think the article says, something like 50 billion robocalls made in this economy every year. I mean, something extraordinary. So clearly it's a problem that is escalating, and federal regulators, they say they're losing. I mean, they admit it.
Right. And those numbers are only going up. According to one index, there were more than 5 billion robocalls in January. So that puts us on track for about 60 billion this year, 175 million a day. Most of those are technically legal. So if you look at one of these databases, the top 10 callers are all debt collectors. And that's annoying but legal. Abramovich was allegedly operating just straight out illegal and annoying. And that's even harder to track, to put numbers on that. So we don't even really know how many fraudsters are out there.
And these calls are unbelievably cheap to make, and technology software lets them be cranked out again by the tens of billions.
That's right. If you've got a laptop or a desktop, download some software, get some server space. You can hire a VoIP.
Voice over IP, yeah.
That's right. You don't even have to push a button in the morning. It'll just do it automatically for you. You can be making money, sitting back, doing nothing.
Okay, don't do that, kids. Don't do that. So look, I don't usually do this in interviews, but I need you to give me the moral of the story here, because technology is letting this facilitates this. Regulators mm-hmm. are, in essence, throwing up their hands. It can be extremely profitable. I got rid of my landline at my house because all we were getting were robocalls. And now we're all on cell phones.
That's right. By the end of this year, half of all U.S. phone traffic is going to be spam traffic or robocalls. So it seems like it's up to consumers right now to deal with. Basically, what people at FTC and FCC told me, and Abramovich, when he was grilled before a Senate committee, said himself, is I just don't answer the phone. You know, if you don't know who's calling, don't pick it up. Right. Someone suggested to me that perhaps the next ploy for robocallers is to pretend to be someone from your contacts, to spoof a contact. But until we get to that point, we're all safe if we just don't answer numbers we don't know.
Alex W. Palmer writing in Wired about robocalls and as Fritz Hollings, the senator, used to call them, the scourge of modern society, right?
That's right. Still are.
Alex, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up.
Come, you know, the 1st of July, 2nd week in July, they typically run out of potatoes.
Never, ever take your French fries for granted, gang. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial snapped a three-day winning streak today, down 79 points on the blue chips, 0.3%, 26,179. The NASDAQ rose 19 points, about 0.25%, 78.48. The S&P 500 basically flat, ending where it started yesterday, 28.67. Told you about the rough quarter at Walgreens earlier. The pharmacy chain dropped 12.8%. Shares in Delta Airlines rose 6% after the company raised its guidance for first quarter earnings and announced a big extension of its credit card deal with American Express. Amex, for whatever this is worth, down 0.6 on that news. Amazon cutting prices at Whole Foods this week. Wall Street Journal reports prices are going to dip on more than 500 products. Amazon shares flat for the day. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.47%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hey, everybody, it's Kai. I want to tell you about another podcast from Marketplace. It's called The Uncertain Hour. This season goes deep inside the war on drugs because to understand how we've handled the opioid crisis so far, you need to go back in history, starting 30 years ago when President George H.W. Bush held up an actual baggie of crack cocaine during his first national televised speech. There is, though, a strange backstory to where that baggie of crack came from, and it's a moment we've been dealing with ever since. The new season is out now. Listen and subscribe to The Uncertain Hour, wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. It has been just a horrible winter up in the Pacific Northwest. Washington and Oregon are just now drying out from one of the coldest and snowiest winters on record, which means farmers, beholden to the weather in the best of times, are already behind the power curve. Potato farmers specifically are a month behind in their planting. And as Anna King from the Northwest News Network reports, that is not going to mean anything good for your French fries.
Ed Snyder has grown French fry making spuds for 40 years. Recently, we walked out in the snow to inspect his unplanted fields. Huge irrigation machines fan out in the distance, dark skeletons against the dirty snow and matching sky.
I mean, this is unheard of. We usually plant last couple days of February and for sure going by March 1. There's been some other years when we're delayed 3 or 4 days, but never 4 weeks. So
a cool spring, along with this late start, could throw his yields off 30 to 40%.
We need some warm, yeah.
Across the Northwest, winter weather has delayed the planting of many crops, but potatoes are on a precise and tight growing schedule. Washington, Oregon, and Idaho farmers grow about 70% of the potatoes for the nation's French fries and processed potatoes like hash browns and tots. And there's more demand than usual this year because last year, a freeze in other parts of the country drew down Northwest supplies. So processors need the fresh crop harvested soon.
Come, you know, the 1st of July, 2nd week in July, they typically run out of potatoes.
Chris Voigt is the head of the Washington State Potato Commission. Typically, those processors hold 34 days worth of frozen fries at the ready.
So let's say you have to dip into your freezer to meet demand and you go from 34 days down to like 28 days. Dipping into the 20s, even though there's still 28 days of French fries available for the rest of the country, you could experience some spot shortages just because, you know, it's going to take some time to get potatoes from Pasco, Washington, or French fries to Miami, Florida.
To feed that crispy golden demand, nearly all Northwest potato growers sign a contract with their processors that sets a hard deadline for the day they have to dig up the spuds. And farmers are paid by the ton for whatever comes out of the ground at that time.
It's scary because, you know, your livelihood's on the line here.
So if potatoes come out small because they haven't had a full growing season, farmers don't make as much money. This year, the late planted spuds will likely weigh less, and that will hurt farmers' income.
20% loss is you're in the red. You know, your kid's not going to college this year if you run across something like that.
Potatoes bump along a conveyor belt where they are washed with dozens of sprayers sized and bagged for the supermarkets. Jared Balcom's family has owned this potato farming and fresh pack company in Pasco for four generations.
We need to have a really nice spring, a really nice summer from Mother Nature to make sure that our crop finishes out the way that it's supposed to.
These are the last of the potatoes he held over from the previous harvest. But at this rate, he expects to run out soon. In Pasco, Washington, I'm Anna King for Marketplace.
This next story is a combination of virtue signaling, manufacturing, environmentalism, and maybe some counterintuitive reality, all in the service of those bans on single-use plastic bags. More than 127 countries have banned those bags. New York State did just this week. But context and caveats, as always, matter. Zoe Schlanger did exactly that in Quartz. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So we're going to get to the caveats that I mentioned in the introduction in a minute, but all other things being equal, which one's better, plastic or cotton tote bags?
That's really rough. I think whatever you have in your house right now is the correct choice. Do not buy anything new. But maybe if you had to just choose one and you have nothing at the moment, a really durable plastic bag that you can use for a very long time and not throw out, that's probably for the best.
Okay, so to the caveats, you report here on a Danish survey that looked, and this is really important, it looked only at the manufacturing process for these single-use plastic bags versus cotton tote bags, right? It didn't look at the litter impact and the fact that, you know, all that plastic gets into the oceans and is terrible for fish and all that. But just on a pure manufacturing basis, cotton tote bags maybe not so good.
Yeah, it's true. This was disheartening to read as someone with a pile of tote bags in her closet. But cotton is one of our thirstiest crops. It uses a massive amount of water to produce. So in terms of a life cycle assessment of cotton, it uses many more environmental resources than making a single plastic bag, which is quite surprising.
Here is the stunning indicator for me. How many more times do I have to use a cotton tote bag to make it and again, this is without any of the litter impacts, but how many times do I have to use it to make it equal one plastic bag?
20,000 times, which probably is going to exceed the lifetime of the actual bag. That thing will fall apart before you use it that many times.
So here comes the public radio cliche. When I give my $50 a month or whatever it is, and I'm offered a tote bag as a gift item, should I say no?
You should actually politely decline. Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah, if you have some totes at home, just use those.
Yeah, and to a more substantive point, you say that what you put in that tote bag, the way you consume in this society, has more to do with whatever kind of bag you use, right?
Yes, researchers that have been involved in these life cycle studies want to point out very clearly that doing things like eating less meat in your diet, walking to the store instead of driving there, will probably over your lifetime have a larger impact on reducing your carbon footprint than avoiding certain bags.
Zoe Schlanger, she covers the environment for Quartz. Zoe, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, in which I apologize basically for my entire gender. Calling back to Justin's story about the pay gap, a survey out today from SurveyMonkey, and yes, questionable reliability of online polls, so stipulated. But come on, listen to this. Nearly half of all men, 46%, believe the pay gap is made up to serve political purposes. Half of male millennials think that men and women are paid equally. And 58% of men think the obstacles that make it harder for women to get ahead are mostly gone. So again, I apologize. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 79 points today, 0.3%. The NASDAQ up 19, 0.25%. S&P 500 was basically flat. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Stephen Bion, Daniel Chiriguayo, Joanne Griffith, Annika Houston, Ben Hethcote, and Sarah Menendez. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Neves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.